Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Mark, the creator of ICU One Pager and the podcast Critical Care Time.
And I'm Dr. Sherry Trivedi, the creator of Core IM.
Before we dive into today's episode, we have some exciting news to share. If you, like us, are passionate about the intersection of technology and medical education, then you won't want to miss an exciting upcoming virtual conference on digital education and AI.
And we're going to have some really great panels from things like, how do you actually get paid for what you love to do in med ed, to how can you use AI to optimize your work life?
Mark your calendars for January 10th, 2025 for the Digital Education and Artificial Intelligence Conference.
Yes. And Nick, I got to say, I am so sincerely excited to attend and learn myself. I know I'm biased in saying this. Yeah. This year, we're actually going to have a prompt-a-thon where people can submit all the creative ways that they've been using AI for categories like in their teaching, for patient care, for their work-life balance, for reducing administrative burden.
Speaking of which, has anyone figured out how we can use ChatGPT to fill out like recredentialing paperwork or like maintenance of certification?
Yes, yes, bless. If anyone's figured all those out, please submit ASAP.
That'll win the competition for sure. Also, I really got to emphasize that this isn't passive. This is going to be hands-on learning with interactive workshops where you'll learn about things like infographics, podcasting, and how to give better talks, and how to disseminate the work that you've made.
I think I'm most excited about the community that we're hoping to create from this. We've really been so thoughtful on the back end of how the day is going to go and the experts we've invited. Actually, at the end of the conference, everyone's going to come away with a living document of all the different submissions and all the different ideas that are going to come out throughout the conference. You're not going to want to miss this.
And speaking of community, there's going to be a virtual lunch networking session where you can eat virtual lunch with thought leaders like Shreya and myself. by the way, what does somebody eat for a virtual lunch?
That is a great question. I'm just like, whatever salad with a side of emojis or... Something else ridiculous.
Pixelated pizza, yeah. Anyway, you are not going to want to miss Digital Education and AI. Follow the link in the show notes, fill out the registration, and we hope to see you on January 10th.
Yes, see you then. Take care.
See you soon.
The other thing that I stress is that urine drug testing is not the only thing or even the most important thing that we pay attention to when we consider how someone's doing with substance use disorder treatment. You know, I think I place a lot more value on things like functional gains, improved self-efficacy, safety, and whole person health, which is, you know, one reason I just love substance use disorder treatment in primary care. Urine drug screening is one piece of the puzzle, but by no means does it, you know, define our treatment success, and definitely it doesn't define the patient.
Who you just heard was Dr. Michael Insa, a primary care and addiction medicine physician at the University of Utah. This is Dr. Marty Fried, a primary care and addiction medicine physician at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. This is the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. Today, we're diving deep into the world of urine drug testing, and I am so excited to be joined again by Dr. Tina Pham, former MedPeds resident from the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. Tina, welcome back.
Yay! Thanks, Marty. Yeah. By the time this episode is out, I'll be officially done with residency and off to start my career as an adult hospitalist at University of Pennsylvania.
I am so excited for you, Tina, and super excited to get to dive into urine drug screening with you.
I'm super pumped too. So this is a topic that can seem simple, like it's either positive or negative, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. There are a lot of nuances here that made us think it's worth diving into with a dedicated Five Pearls episode. And heads up, we'll sometimes be shortening urine drug screening to UDS.
If you're into the whole brevity thing. All right, Tina, let's get into the topics we'll be covering today.
Pearl 1, approaching urine drug screening with patients.
Why, when, and how often should we screen for drug use? And how should we discuss urine drug testing with our patients?
Pearl 2, the immunoassay.
What is an immunoassay drug screen, and what are some sources for common false positives and false negatives?
Pearl 3, the gas chromatography mass spectrometry, also known as GCMS.
What is a GCMS drug test, and how should we interpret those results?
Pearl 4, discussing results of drug screening.
How can we preserve the patient-doctor relationship while discussing unexpected results of a urine drug screen?
Pearl Pearl 5, throwback to five pearls on stigma in opiate use disorder.
What are some ways that we can reduce harm in describing the results of a urine drug screen? And what can we offer if our patient has returned to using drugs?
All right, Marty, we've got a lot to cover. So let's get started.
For sure, Tina. So first question, what are some reasons to ask patients to submit urine drug screen in the first place?
That's a great starting point and super important question, Marty. Sometimes we ask for urine drug testing, not because we want to, but because we have to.
You do have to sort of be aware of, you know, sort of like local laws and institutional policies. You don't like run afoul of them because that's not going to help anybody. And B, so you can work to change them. And
yes, we need to be aware of local requirements, but this is also an opportunity to influence those policies. Sometimes we send urine drug screens reflexively and without centering the patient and their goals in that decision. The lesson for me here is to try and avoid the automatic UDS without a thoughtful approach.
And outside of because we have to, Dr. Insa did bring up some good reasons why we should test and how he frames it to his patients. In fact, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, or ASAM, published consensus recommendations that offer several reasons why we should test too.
I frame it as the same reason that we would check like a blood pressure in somebody with hypertension or an A1C in someone with diabetes, right? Not as like a gotcha kind of test, or not because we don't think that they're trying really hard and adhering to all of the elements that we recommend for treatment. Just we want to see if our treatment's working. I stress that urine drug testing only is going to be used to like add to their treatment. The results of a urine drug test should be used to augment the treatment we offer to folks, not to take it away or to deny folks treatment.
Right. Never use drug screening to punish. It's a tool to support recovery. And sometimes the UDS can be a powerful motivator if the patient's goals are to remain abstinent.
Exactly. And another reason why a UDS can be so beneficial is to assess for possible drug-drug interactions or unintended exposures.
If a patient is taking other medications that could potentially put them in harm's way, especially if they have a return to use, stuff like gabapentin or prescribed benzodiazepines or prescription stimulants, I do, you know, just again, for patient safety reasons, recommend more frequent testing in those circumstances.
Yeah, so this is a super important tenet of harm reduction. If our patients return to use, we want them to be as safe as possible. And there's a growing appreciation for the presence of gabapentin in opioid overdose deaths, suggesting that there could be a greater risk of respiratory depression for patients using both of those classes of medicine.
And maybe we aren't the ones prescribing gabapentin or benzodiazepine, but we can use the drug screen here to counsel patients to be extra careful, like doubling down on a recommendation not to use alone.
And there's a similar point to be made here with prescription and illicit amphetamine use. If we find methamphetamine in the urine of a patient we are prescribing stimulants to, we might have to adjust the treatment plan because taking those together can be dangerous.
And I think one of the primary reasons I recommend urine drug screening is because the, you know, illicit drug supply right now is just so poisoned and adulterated with all kinds of things that I just, you know, frame it like you deserve to know, you know, what you're putting in your body. And this is one test that can help with that.
Yeah, the current state of the world is that we have a ubiquitously poisoned drug supply. I've had patients discover fentanyl in their urine when that was not what they were seeking to use. And that was tremendously motivating for them to check their supply with fentanyl test strips. And I've even had patients commit to abstinence when that was not their initial goal after discovering unintended fentanyl metabolites in their urine.
Wow. Okay. Last question for this pearl about general approaches to urine drug screening. Are there any guidelines about how frequently we should do urine drug screens?
Yeah, so the ASAM guidelines acknowledge that there really is no evidence-based schedule. In general, more frequent testing upfront for patients early in treatment for substance use disorders and less frequent as they continue on.
For patients who are really stable, I might check once a year.
And this is one of those situations where your state or institution might have regulations that drive testing frequency.
Yeah, so what I'm hoping that people take away is that a UDS can help providers verify adherence to treatment for opioid use disorder and assess for drug-drug interactions and unintentional exposures, with fentanyl being the scariest and unfortunately the most common one. My biggest takeaway, though, is that a UDS should never be used against a patient for punitive measures. It should only be used to help guide treatment. And lastly, we just need to be honest with our patients about frequency and goals of testing. A little compassion up front can prevent our patients from feeling alienated later on.
So now let's talk about the test itself. Tina, what are the categories here for urine drug screening?
Okay, Marty, get ready for this organic chemistry throwback. There are two main types of urine drug tests: immunoassays as the typical first-line test, and confirmatory tests, which use gas chromatography with mass spectrometry. Bet you thought those days were behind you.
Oh my gosh, you bet I did, Tina. All right, so as I try to suppress some serious OChem nightmares, let's get a bit granular here. How do we know if the urine drug screens that we are ordering are immunoassays or the confirmatory tests?
So your routine urine drug screen or UDS panel is typically going to be the immunoassay test that we'll talk about in this pearl. The gas chromatography mass spectrometry tests are usually labeled as confirmation and typically sent for single specific drugs, single medications, or medication classes like benzodiazepine confirmation.
Right. So in our shop, there's a 10-drug panel that includes immunoassays for 10 commonly encountered medications and drugs. We can then order confirmatory tests on top of the panel for each of those drugs and medications, and those tests are labeled specifically as confirmatory tests.
Okay, so I'm still following here, but what exactly do we mean when we say immunoassay?
The immunoassay-based methods are going to be the more common testing that you might be used to. These are available in most, you know, hospital laboratories. They're also available at the point of care, if you've ever seen like the urine drug screening cups. And the way that those work are we have these antibodies. They're raised to detect a certain drug within a drug class. The disadvantage of immunoassays is that they really don't have single drug level of specificity. They generally react with structurally similar compounds within a drug class.
That was Dr. Heather Stieglitz, a clinical analytical toxicologist at The Ohio State University. So the immunoassay-based testing uses antibodies to detect drugs or drug classes. This offers the upside of being relatively cheap and available for point-of-care testing, but at the cost of reduced specificity, since it might also detect other compounds of structural similarity to the substance that you're interested in.
Yeah, so a crucial point here is that immunoassays are qualitative, yes or no, versus confirmatory mass specs, which are quantitative and can tell you how much of that substance is present.
That's definitely helpful to know. And here's a quick word about drug panels.
So there really is no standard urine drug screen panel, especially when it comes to clinical toxicology. The decision for what drug classes to include on a urine drug screen is really a decision that's made up at each individual lab, at each individual hospital.
Right. So the lesson here is that we should be aware about what is in our shop's standard drug screen panel, as these are probably built in-house in response to local needs.
Definitely. But let's switch gears and talk about the limitations of immunoassays.
Probably like the most common thing that primary care physicians should know is that most immunoassay-based tests don't detect synthetic or most semi-synthetic opioids, right? And so, and that is especially true for fentanyl. So, you know, your urine drug screen could be negative for opiates if somebody was just exclusively using fentanyl.
So what Dr. Insa is referring to here is the difference between an opiate and an opioid. Opiates are naturally occurring substances derived from the poppy plant. These include codeine, hydrocodone, morphine. In contrast, opioids are synthetic or semi-synthetic substances like fentanyl and oxycodone. So if your UDS only includes opiates, your patient might be being exposed to scary stuff like fentanyl, and we'd never know.
And we know that the difference between opioids and opiates can be confusing. So check out our infographic about this and how it relates to UDS testing.
And this brings up another good point about immunoassays. The interpretation can be super challenging.
The biggest disadvantage with immunoassays is that specificity. So they're antibodies, they're raised to detect a certain drug within a drug class. But in actuality, they actually can cross-react and detect many different compounds within that same drug class that just have structural similarity. They have really great specificity when you're asking them to differentiate between big molecules, like differentiate between different proteins or peptides, but they aren't quite as good when you're asking them to differentiate between subtle changes of small molecules, you know, like changes in, you know, different functional groups.
Okay, and just to drive this point home, I'm going to torture you with some OChem again. What is the difference between bupropion and amphetamine?
I mean, that kind of sounds like a joke with a cheap punchline. I don't know. Chuck Norris.
What?
Yeah.
No. The difference between bupropion and amphetamine is actually pretty similar. It's only a chloride atom, a ketone group, and a bundle of methyl groups. It's like basically the same thing.
Yeah, I feel like we're probably going to have to show a picture of these OChem goobers in the show notes. So check that out to see the actual difference.
Oh, 100%. But the moral of the story here is that given how subtle the molecular difference is between amphetamine and bupropion, it shouldn't be too surprising when the immunoassay we sent looks like our patient on bupropion is taking unprescribed Adderall and amphetamine. This is a super common false positive on immunoassays.
All right. Any other false positives come up in our discussion with the experts?
Yeah. So another common one is sertraline. It will sometimes cross-react with benzodiazepine assays, and there are a whole host of other common sources of false positives that we'll link to in our show notes. Also, check out the infographic about what they might show up as on a UDS.
And what about false negatives? Any particularly important situations where a medication we would expect to see might not actually show up in the immunoassay drug screen?
Like one of the ones that comes up most commonly, just, you know, with colleagues asking me about, for example, is the false negative that many kind of typical immunoassay-based screening tests in primary care have for clonazepam. So they'll be like totally freaked out that they're prescribing clonazepam to this person, which is already making them nervous, you know, a PCP. And then, you know, the test is negative and they're like, what? I can't believe it. But, you know, like almost always that's a shortcoming of the test.
Wow. Yeah, I can see a lot of docs getting tripped up about the perceived absence of clonazepam in their patient's urine. I mean, already they're a little freaked out about prescribing benzos, and then bam, no drug, you're out, without necessarily understanding the limitations of that test.
So the various, you know, benzodiazepine screens have antibodies that are raised to detect, you know, different types of benzodiazepines. In the assay that we use in my lab, the antibody is raised to detect lormitazepam. And while it does cross-react fairly well with clonazepam isn't actually the compound that is present in high concentrations in urine of patients taking clonazepam. You're going to find more of its major metabolite, 7-aminoclonazepam. Now, 7-aminoclonazepam does not show substantial cross-reactivity in the assay. So if you're using the benzodiazepine screen to try to assess compliance with taking clonazepam, that's another situation where it's going to appear unreliable, or you're going to get more false negatives because the assay just doesn't show substantial cross-reactivity to that particular metabolite.
Exactly. And methylphenidate is another one that we should be careful about.
The amphetamine screen is designed to detect amphetamine and methamphetamine. That's what the antibodies are raised to detect. It has some cross-reactivity to MDMA or MDA, and so it can detect other, you know, structurally related stimulants, but it doesn't detect all stimulants. So methylphenidate, for example, generally, you know, a lot of amphetamine screens don't have great cross-reactivity to methylphenidate. So if that's what you're asking, you know, the amphetamines assay to detect, then you're going to probably find that assay to be fairly unreliable because that assay was not designed to detect methylphenidate.
Okay, so clonazepam and methylphenidate are medications that are fairly reliably won't show up in our immunoassay drug screen. I'm feeling like I should be second-guessing everything at this point. Are there any situations where a result on the immunoassay is actually pretty solid, like high probability that a positive result is actually a positive result?
Cocaine is my favorite immunoassay. That is because it is very, very specific. So the antibody in the immunoassay for cocaine is raised to detect benzylecanine, which is a major metabolite of cocaine. And I have personally never seen an immunoassay positive result that we did not confirm by a mass spectrometry-based assay the presence of benzylecanine.
Hallelujah, an amino assay that I can trust.
Oh my gosh. And just to clarify those terms, benzoylecanine is the urinary metabolite of cocaine, and the amino assay for benzoylecanine is super specific.
Oh my gosh, benzoylecanine, 7-aminoclonazepam, these are terms that just roll off the tongue. I mean, Tina, who becomes an organic chemist, honestly? All right, let's summarize this section.
I'm just so thankful that someone wants to be an organic chemist, because I definitely
am. Amen.
But for sure. So the take-home point here is to understand the difference between the two major categories of drug screens. Immunoassays, which use antibodies that are quick and cheap, but might be positive for substances outside of what you're looking for. And gas chromatography, mass spectrometry tests, which have single drug specificity and are typically used for confirmation. It's important to know what's on the drug panel at your local institution. And if it's only testing for opiates, make sure you're checking for important opioids like fentanyl, oxycodone, methadone, or buprenorphine.
And there are some really important common sources of false positive with immunoassays, like how bupropion may result in an immunoassay positive for amphetamines, and a few important false negatives, like the perceived absence of clonazepam or methylphenidate on most immunoassays. Cocaine is cocaine, and if you see that on an immunoassay, you probably don't need the confirmatory test.
All right, Marty, it's time to move on to important points about the confirmatory testing assays, gas chromatography and mass spectrometry. From here on out, we'll use the shorthand GCMS.
The other large grouping of toxicology tests are chromatography-based methods. Chromatography generally paired with some kind of mass spectrometry detection. The main advantage of this type of testing is that it is highly specific. Chromatography, mass spectrometry-based methods have single drug layer specificity. So, for example, you can differentiate between morphine and codeine. The disadvantages of the chromatography-based methods is that they're much more complex. These are only available in, you know, specialized toxicology laboratories.
Okay, so the TLDR of this section is that the confirmatory testing using GCMS is highly specific for single drugs or drug metabolites. So there are relatively few false positives at the cost of, well, cost. And maybe time, if it's a send-out test at your lab.
And just to torch you a little bit more here, Marty, how the GC and MS work together is clinically important. Chromatography allows for the separation of the specimen into component parts, with mass spectrometry identifying those parts. Mass spectrometry also allows for quantitative measurement of the concentration of a specific substance.
Okay, so unlike using an antibody from the immunoassay tests to see what sticks, the chromatography isolates various metabolites from the sample, and the mass spec identifies and counts them, basically.
Okay, makes sense. But I have a question. How do we figure out which test to order?
I will warn you that if you have an unexpected result, and that unexpected result is from an immunoassay, I'm probably going to tell you the same thing, and that is order a confirmation test.
Tina, I am considering myself warned. JK, I email Heather all the time, and she is absolutely wonderful.
I'm sorry. I think we're in the wrong decade for you to be using JK.
I will not let that go.
JK, I still use that term too. But no, Dr. Stieglitz was very kind and knowledgeable. Basically, she's emphasizing that the ambiguities that come up with immunoassays are significantly reduced when you follow that up with a confirmatory GCMS.
For sure. One thing that came up as we were talking to our experts about how to figure out which test to order is that sometimes you don't actually have to decide to get a confirmatory GCMS. It might actually happen automatically.
Right. So these are called reflex assays. The lab will automatically send confirmatory GCMS assays on all positive immunoassay test results within a UDS.
Right. So this can be helpful because we just heard Dr. Stieglitz tell us that if there are any questions about an immunoassay, we should get the confirmatory GCMS. And the reflex assay will do that automatically, like every time. That is both the blessing and the curse of the reflex assay.
So it's a blessing because it happens automatically, but it's also a curse because we might not actually need that confirmatory GCMS test every time.
Right. The ASAM guidelines on urine drug screen recommend that the testing be tailored to the clinical situation, and we should selectively confirm positive tests.
So for example, if you and your patient have already discussed their fentanyl relapse and the immunoassay shows fentanyl, we probably don't need the confirmatory GC-MS that a reflex test would order automatically.
Right. So our job is to pick the times when we would definitely want the confirmatory test and either order the reflex testing or wait for the immunoassay to come back and see if we can add on the confirmatory GC-MS test on the sample that's already been collected.
Yeah. So now our last point about interpreting GC-MS actually requires a little bit of knowledge about urinary metabolites for opioids.
So for many of the urinary metabolites of opioids, you'll see a lot of NOR in front of the medication name. Like the urinary metabolite of oxycodone is noroxycodone. We also have norfentanyl and norbuprenorphine. That NOR signifies that it's a metabolite of the medication, and when it appears in the results of a quantitative mass spec test, you can be fairly confident that the medication was taken, metabolized, and passed in the urine. And that is a unique feature of GC-MS tests, not immunoassays.
So immunoassays will tell us yes or no for any particular medication or drug, but GC-MS will tell us what specific metabolite is present in the urine. This is a pretty important point when trying to figure out if a patient has been tampering with their urine drug screen.
So if you have, say, an immunoassay screen for buprenorphine, and it just elicits a positive for buprenorphine, you can't really differentiate what is that urine test positive because the patient actually took buprenorphine or because they just added buprenorphine directly to the urine. However, if you get a mass spectrometry-based confirmation test and you can measure the quantitative concentrations of buprenorphine and norbuprenorphine, then you can look at those quantitative results. And if you see really, really, really high concentrations of buprenorphine and very low or undetectable amounts of norbuprenorphine, that's a situation that's suggestive of the patient directly adding buprenorphine to their urine as opposed to physiologically taking it.
Diabolical.
The pattern you're looking for to confirm a positive buprenorphine screen is a GC-MS that has a high level of norbuprenorphine, indicating that the metabolized compound is present in high concentration, and also a relatively lower concentration of unmetabolized buprenorphine.
I mean, I'm just impressed by the ingenuity.
I mean, listen, our experts didn't indicate that this happens often, but recognizing when this does happen is important because it represents an opportunity for us to check in with our patients about how things are going.
Totally. And we'll talk about how to address urine drug screen results in the next Pearl. But first, we should probably be clear about the limitations of a UDS in terms of what it can tell us about our patients.
A urine drug screen cannot diagnose a substance use disorder, right? Like there are diagnostic criteria for a substance use disorder, and urine drug screening is not one of them. And so I think you have to be really careful in how you interpret that and not to use that as a diagnostic tool, but rather a screening tool for substance use.
This is huge. A lot of docs and most trainees can identify a substance use disorder is a pattern of compulsive drug use that affects various elements of someone's life. But we should stop for a moment to realize that the results of a urine drug test is not found anywhere in the DSM criteria for the diagnosis of any substance use disorder.
Exactly. So drug tests screen for substance use, not substance use disorders. There are tons of validated screeners out there for opiate use disorder and alcohol use disorder and others. And we couldn't find a single screener that includes results of urine drug tests. So these screen for substance use, and that's something we shouldn't forget.
Totally, Tina. So to summarize what I'm taking away from this Pearl is that the first step to interpreting an unexpected result is to check the confirmatory GC-MS test. Remember that the pattern of opioid metabolites matter. If your patient is taking a medication that contains buprenorphine, we expect to see a high ratio of norbuprenorphine to buprenorphine in the urine. If that ratio is flipped and we see more bup and low or absent norbup, then we should be seriously considering medication spiking, and we would want to check in with our patient. All right, so Tina, at this point, hopefully we've clarified some ambiguities around urine drug screen interpretation, but I feel like that's actually not the hardest part of the test. I've been talking about results of urine drug screens with patients for a long time, and I still worry I might mess up all that trust and rapport that I built with patients when I have to address a urine drug screen that has some positives that we didn't expect.
You know, Marty, I think it's safe to say that you're probably not the only one who feels that way. It's tempting to fixate on that bad news discussion, but Dr. Insa actually has a super pragmatic way to talk about drug screens.
You know, like I put that on my agenda for the visit, but I don't start with it. Usually I just start it like I would any other primary care visit. How have things been going? You know, address whatever other concerns that that person has, other health things that we're working on. And then eventually, you know, I kind of circle around to the substance use disorder. And as a part of that, I address the urine drug screen. And usually I just say it and then let there be a little bit of silence, you know, like, hey, your urine drug testing was positive for benzodiazepines this time. And I wasn't expecting that. And then just wait. and then one or two things will happen. You know, the patient will most typically, in my experience at least, and especially if you've developed a good rapport with this person over time, will either tell you like, hey, this is what's been going on. And that can lead open a new door into like augmenting treatment and, you know, et cetera. Or they'll say like, absolutely not. I did not use that substance. And then I think in that case, it's really worth it to take a minute to think about the shortcomings of the urine drug test and the possibility that there could be a false positive or a false negative.
I love this. So it seems like the best method is to come from a non-judgmental stance and just tackle it like any other primary care issue.
Well, yeah, I do think that clarifying someone's goals around substance use is a really important part of substance use disorder treatment. You know, like maybe people don't completely desire like 100% abstinence. I have patients that are like that. They're like, look, I'm going to continue to use every now and again. Because it helps with this or because I like it or because of whatever reason. I think you have to align your goals with them.
Yeah, this is great. I love checking in about goals of abstinence in the setting of ongoing drug use because it affirms that I'm really here for the patient no matter what. And for those folks who really do want to avoid drugs or alcohol, it brings out some amazing change talk that I can then amplify with reflective statements.
So is that you being a motivational interviewing wizard there, Marty?
Listen, Tina, I'm by no means an MI wizard, but there are times when it is helpful, and this is for sure one of them.
I think just helping to clarify goals, and if the goal is not to stop using immediately, to like make sure that you just turn the harm reduction up to 11. And then if someone's goal is to stop using, then just, you know, to help get them started back on treatment for that.
Okay, dialing harm reduction up to 11, I love that. And we'll highlight more of that in the final pearl. But first, Marty, tell us what you're taking away from this section.
Definitely. So this pearl is all about normalizing the discussion around an unexpectedly positive urine drug screen test. We don't have to start the conversation with finger wagging. Try to find a way to start the conversation with your patient about something other than their positive test and use positive drug screens as a chance to check in about recovery goals. Because we are here for our patients, regardless of if they want to use or if they want to abstain.
Okay, so let's finish this episode with a throwback to our Five Pearls on Stigma and Opiate Use Disorder podcast. One of the biggest takeaways I had from this was all of the different ways we can avoid stigmatizing language when we're discussing results of a urine drug screen.
For sure. I still remember the story that Dr. Wakeman shared in that episode about her friend who was asked how long they had been quote unquote clean for. And the person's response was that they had been bathing since they were a child and been in recovery for at least 5 years. It was a good reminder for me that this really has nothing to do with hygiene.
Jeez, that is such a shame. So maybe let's refer to urine drug screens as either positive or negative instead of dirty or clean.
Exactly. And we just heard Dr. Insa mention to crank up the harm reduction for patients whose goal is not to stop using drugs immediately. Tina, can you remind us about some of the harm reduction strategies that came up in the stigma episode?
Yeah, so this was a learning point for me. A few ways we can help with risk reduction include providing access to test strips for both fentanyl and xylazine, connecting patients to syringe exchange programs, and of course, making sure that they have Narcan nearby.
Yeah, discussing injection practices with our patients can be really informative. And this is a situation where hygiene matters. So talk about washing hands before injecting or cleaning the skin over an injection site.
And if your patient is musing alone without someone nearby, there are more and more hotlines nowadays. You can call to share your location and someone will stay on the phone to activate emergency services if help is needed.
And if you want to hear an amazing story about one of those programs, check out a This American Life episode entitled The Call. It's about one of those programs called the Never Use Alone Hotline.
I'll definitely have to check that out now, Marty. So this is actually a wrap for this episode. If you found it helpful, please share this with your colleagues and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use.
And again, thank you to our peer reviewers, to be named later, which I will record in a little bit. All right, everybody. Thank you very much.
Bye.
See ya.
Black Friday is coming, and for the adults in your life who love the coolest toys, well, there's something for them this year, too. Bartesian is the premier craft cocktail maker that automatically makes more than 60 seasonal and classic cocktails, each in under 30 seconds at the push of a button. And right now, Bartesian is having a huge site-wide sale. You can get $100 off any cocktail maker or cocktail maker bundle when you spend $400 or more. So, if the cocktail lover in your life has been good this year, or the right kind of bad, get them Bartesian. At the push of a button, make bar-quality cosmopolitans, martinis, Manhattans, and more. All in just 30 seconds. All for 100 off. Amazing toys aren't just for kids. Get 100 off a cocktail maker when you spend 400 through Cyber Monday. Visit bartesian.com/cocktail. That's BARTESIAN.com/cocktail.